If there's one person in Congress you would want to talk to about the House tax bill, it's the guy who wrote it. So we did. Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady coming up. Also, and related, how sometimes tax bills don't do what you want them to do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 30th of November. Good as always to have you here, everybody. It is all over but the shouting in the Senate, it seems. Voting on the Republican tax plan is going to start later tonight or maybe tomorrow. But either way, more holdouts on the bill look like they are working their way to yes on the thing. The House, remember, passed its bill a couple of weeks ago, a bill with some significant differences from the Senate version. So that is where I started this afternoon with House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady in his office in the Capitol. Basically, I said, how are you going to make these two bills agree?
Well, look, I have a simple philosophy here. Let's pick the best of both the House and the Senate tax reform bills. Let's look at making this tax reform better at every step. And that conference committee allows us to continue to do that. There are strengths and weaknesses in all these proposals, but listening to our members who represent the whole country about what's really important to them and how we can improve it has actually helped us a great deal every step. So I'm really eager in the conference committee to work out and find that common ground.
Give me a sense of the biggest sticking points.
Here's the good news. Because we'd worked with President Trump on one framework, both the House and Senate really wrote toward a pro-growth tax reform. There are some differences in how we structure help for small businesses, how we deal with all of these U.S. companies and jobs and research going overseas, and more importantly, how do we bring them back?
Yeah.
The good news is I think we're all headed the same direction. We just took some different approaches. I don't see anything that isn't solvable in a really positive way.
Since you mentioned the growth that y'all are counting on in these bills, you're counting on it to pay for itself. The White House has said so. You've said so. Everybody is saying so. My question then is, how come, in your mind, the Senate is less confident? They're less optimistic. They're including these triggers, and there's a whole lot of what-ifs.
So I want to make one change to the question.
Sure.
So I believe tax reform can lead us back to a balanced budget. You'll need two things, though. One, good, strong economic growth, because I'm convinced a sure way to continue these deficits is keep this very slow economy the last decade. But that's not enough. You have to also eliminate a lot of unnecessary provisions and lobbyist loopholes and exclusions in the tax code to be able to help pay for this as well.
But the Senate's not so sure. They've got these trigger provisions. If the deficit increases, if growth doesn't come, how are you going to reconcile that?
So right?
That's the challenge. Yeah,
here's what I support: letting the Senate do its very best job here. I really do. I love this process. The House has acted very decisively. The Senate is really, I think, taking very positive steps. So they produce the very best product, and then we go to work to find common ground.
Virtually all analysis shows that the bulk of the tax cuts and the bulk of the benefit of this bill go to the wealthy in America.
Yeah, and that's absolutely incorrect.
No, sir, it's not.
Come on. Actually,
it is. You
look
at the CBO, you look at the joint
tax. No, joint tax.
Right?
Let's start with them. So, one, sure. CBO doesn't estimate the tax plans. Secondly, Joint Committee believes that there's income relief at every level, income level. And when you look at both the tax cuts, which in the House plan, 70% of the tax cuts go to families, households, making less than $200,000. You think, well, is that the middle class? You know, between $50,000 and $200,000 in some of these high-tax states, yeah, that's sort of the middle class, two workers, two kids, you know, working from paycheck to paycheck. They get good, strong tax relief, as they should.
Let me get from individuals to corporations. The House bill and the Senate bill include big tax cuts for corporations. I guess my question is, Fortune 500 companies are having record profits. The economy is growing. We just saw GDP out the other day. Why does corporate America need tax relief right now?
Well, here's a simple question. Are Americans tired of watching their jobs in their headquarters, in the research, and their manufacturing go overseas? The answer is yes.
Yeah, but sir.
No, but our tax code in that the highest rate among our competitors, if you've got the highest prices of all your competitors, I guarantee you people are buying elsewhere. Well, guess what? these jobs are going elsewhere as well.
So the
20% rate, it makes America competitive, along with other provisions, helps leapfrog us back into the lead pack so that we can compete against China and Europe, Canada and Mexico. So I often think the public looks at the wrong P word, profitability, versus the one we're really focused on, productivity, because that's what's missing. Right now, that's missing in America. We've fallen. Boy, last year, I think we gave back 6 years of productivity. So, that really hurts families.
I was going to skip a productivity question, but now that you brought it up, I want to poke you in the eye a little bit on this. And I saw you say this on CNBC the other day. Explain to me how corporate tax cuts are going to increase worker productivity.
Yeah, so because you're only looking at one provision. Not just the tax cuts, so that you can make an investment knowing you're going to return, and you can compete against that Chinese company and that European company. That's really good for workers. But we also unleash full and unlimited investment. So for the first time in history, we give companies a zero tax rate when they invest in their workers and in that new technology. That drives the productivity, that really drives paychecks.
Just to square the circle here for a second, it's investment that you're counting on in an unproven tax bill that is hopefully going to work out the way you want it to, right?
Well, here's the good news. It's already been proven. We know from President JFK's tax cuts as well as President Reagan's tax cuts, you saw this happen. When America became competitive and families and businesses could keep more of what they earn, the economy took off. In fact, the 20 years after President Reagan, we saw 37 million new jobs, almost 20 years of almost unbroken prosperity. Right now, unless America wants to settle for this sub 2% economic growth, which hurts our families, we have to make a change.
Kevin Brady, Chairman of House Ways and Means. Thanks for your time, sir.
Thanks for having me.
I should say, by the way, after Chairman Brady and I spoke, the Joint Committee on Taxation came out with its analysis of the Senate bill. It's only going to generate enough economic growth, the JCT says, to pay for about a third of the $1.5 trillion in tax cuts that are in the thing. Wall Street today, I'll tell you what, you give traders a whiff of a tax cut bill getting passed, look out, Dow 24K. This Thursday, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Every now and then when we talk about equities, that is stocks, we talk about volatility, big price swings, often without a clear cause. Volatility exhibit A of late has not been stocks, though. It's been Bitcoin. The cryptocurrency is on a wild ride up 1,100% the past year to a high of more than $11,000 to one Bitcoin yesterday. And then, in accordance with the laws of volatility, falling a couple of percent today. Everybody, it seems, wants in on the Bitcoin action. But a growing number of economists and investment advisors are trying to warn people off of this stuff. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth explains why.
My friends Melissa and Danny are getting married this weekend. Lisa Munoz says there's a lot to do.
I have to think about alcohol. How many people are coming? Do we have enough chairs for them? What are they going to eat? Mare's allergic to everything. How are we getting to the venue? How are we leaving to the venue? What are my nails going to look like?
And where's the groom during all this?
He's monitoring Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm here.
Danny?
I mean, I spend probably a couple hours a day, you know, just checking it maybe every 2-3 hours or so.
Danny Mann's been reading about Bitcoin for years, but he only got in the game this March. In 9 months, he's up about 50%.
I think people who own these things have a certain appetite for risk.
David Yermak teaches at NYU Stern. He says Danny's far from the only daredevil out there, but that what Bitcoin players have to understand is this isn't your normal risk-reward calculation. In the stock market, you're rewarded for systematic risk based on the fundamentals of a company or industry.
What you're talking about with digital currencies is much more idiosyncratic risk, which is unique to the asset but not tied to the overall economy.
In other words, the price of Bitcoin isn't tied to anything except what people think about the price of Bitcoin. What's more, says Mona Mahajan of Allianz Global Investors, cryptocurrencies can be hacked and they're not regulated.
If you're going to put your piggy bank in Bitcoin today, your money may be gone in a few years.
Ironically, Bitcoin's very popularity may be its undoing. Other cryptocurrencies like Ethereum are growing faster and taking its market share, which could eventually drive down the price. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
If Amazon gets its way, some companies may be welcoming a new assistant soon. The retail behemoth has plans to bring its Echo devices into boardrooms through a platform called Alexa for Business. It's Amazon's latest move in a competitive voice assistant space. But what all might Alexa do at work? And do companies necessarily want that? Because Alexa, tell me a joke only gets you so far. Marketplace's Rima Kreis asks away.
You know those clumsy video conference calls at work? The ones that never start on time because the cord is missing, or Joey in Chicago can't connect, or no one in the room knows the passcode? Well, Amazon wants you to just ask Alexa to start it.
Voice is a very natural way of doing it, you know, rather than thinking about clicking on all the different buttons to make all that happen.
Chris Voci is an analyst at Forrester Research. He says Alexa for Business has relationships with common office tools like Microsoft Exchange and Cisco. Voci says that means workers can ask Alexa stuff like,
cancel my meetings for the rest of the day with my boss.
Or look up my flights to Baltimore.
Or order new pencils.
Companies will also be able to build Alexa skills specific to their needs. Alexa for Business comes through Amazon Web Services. That's its cloud computing business, not the retail side. It's betting on voice technology in the workplace, says Roger Kay. He heads up Endpoint Technologies Associates.
Amazon arguably has the best artificial intelligence utility at the moment. So it's kind of a strong suit for the company, and it's going to cause the others like Google and Microsoft to scramble.
Microsoft's virtual assistant Cortana is already embedded in Windows 10 computers. David Schubmill is a research director with IDC. He says Alexa could cause some workers to get distracted or worry about eavesdropping, but he says companies, like people, love to simplify.
Alexa has been a runaway hit in the consumer market, and I think that we'll see that level of pickup in the enterprise.
Assuming, of course, Alexa can get that video conference call to work. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Today in Irony, Thy Name is Brexit, this item. The British government published its latest immigration figures today, covering the 12 months since June 2016, which was, of course, when Brits voted to leave the European Union. That was a vote shaped in no small part by immigration and the desire by yes voters, a lot of them anyway, to let fewer people into that country. Well, here you go. Today's numbers show the sharpest drop in net inward migration since London started keeping track more than 50 years ago. And that plays into the British labor pool, economic growth, a whole bunch of other stuff, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London.
The UK's population growth through immigration fell by almost a third in the year following the Brexit referendum. That's a net figure of 106,000 fewer immigrants arriving to settle in Britain than the year before. Immigration Minister Brandon Lewis proudly declared the government was delivering on a key election pledge.
It shows that we are doing the work to deliver on that journey to reduce net migration, which we outlined was our long-term ambition and something we outlined in our manifesto.
The bulk of the fall in immigration was due to citizens from other EU countries staying away. And that's worrying some businesses, like the hotel trade, which often struggle to recruit British nationals. Hotel manager Sally Beck is fretting about possible damage to her industry.
The open borders policy that we've always had has been critical to us. We need 200,000 EU nationals a year just to stand still.
She's worried the Brexit vote may have made EU nationals feel unwelcome in Britain, but Sarah Crofts of the Office of National Statistics says we need to take a closer look at the figures.
We're seeing very similar numbers coming in who are arriving for a definite job. We've seen no change there between the figures. But where we have seen a change is a fall of 43% in those coming to look for work.
The government says that shows British business can still attract the talent it needs. And it points out the number of EU nationals applying for UK citizenship over the past year has almost doubled. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up.
Are we playing the hot potato game?
Yeah!
Yes, we are playing hot potato with pre-K, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go, the very happy music. Although, remember, 24,000 is just a number. The Dow Industrial's up 1.33% today, 331 points, closed to 24,272. NASDAQ up 0.7%, 49 points, 68.73. The S&P 500 up 0.8%, 21 points, 26.47. Financials boosted major indices today. Shares of JPMorgan Chase up 0.7%. Citigroup up about 0.6%. American Airlines trying to quell passenger angst says out of 200,000 flights, now only just a couple of hundred of them without assigned pilots for the December travel season, as we ended the broadcast yesterday. American shares up 2.5% today. Delta lifted 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, has been making the rounds on Capitol Hill this week. Why, you ask? Taxes, of course. Brownback was talking up his tax cuts in Kansas from 5 years ago, offering them as a model for congressional Republicans to follow. Cut taxes on the rich, watch the economic benefits trickle down to everybody else. Thing is, the years since those cuts took effect in Kansas have not been kind to the governor or to his state. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
In 2012, Kansas cut the tax rate for certain businesses to zero. It slashed income taxes. It reduced the number of tax brackets. Here's Governor Sam Brownback back then.
This is like shooting adrenaline into the heart of growing the economy.
Fast forward to 2017.
It wasn't a shot of adrenaline. Kansas had stagnant growth, three credit downgradings, and we had a $1 billion deficit.
Democrat Jim Ward is the minority leader in Kansas legislature. He led the charge this past summer to repeal the Brownback tax cuts.
You should look at it and learn from it. You shouldn't replicate it.
This is the argument many Democrats have made. But the comparison between Kansas and the GOP tax plan in reality only goes so far.
There are some similarities. However, there's a lot more differences.
Kenneth Criz is professor of public finance at Wichita State University.
The Kansas plan did not touch the corporate tax.
But he says a more glaring difference between the Kansas cuts and the GOP tax cuts is that Kansas is required to balance its budget, at least on paper. So, for example, Kansas had to make disastrous cuts to its education system to pay for tax cuts. Congress has more leeway. It can increase the deficit to some extent. But Criz says he does see one big similarity between the Kansas tax cuts and the GOP tax cuts.
Both of the plans have been completely oversold.
Tax cuts, he says, have been shown time and time again to be pretty weak drivers of economic growth. Bradley Heim is a professor at Indiana University who's researched the aftermath of the Kansas tax cuts.
At the end of the day, Kansas didn't see a big explosion in growth and entrepreneurship.
He says he'd be surprised if, at the national level, that result was any different. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
As you heard me talking about with Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady up at the top of the program, at the heart of both the House and Senate tax bills is a big cut in corporate tax rates. Because, as you heard him say, Republicans believe those cuts will get the economy growing faster once companies spend what they are not paying in taxes. Economics is nothing, though, if not a study of the law of unintended consequences. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains.
If corporations get a tax cut, they could, in theory, take the money they save and use it to grow, to make acquisitions, buy equipment, hire people. But Robert H. Frank, who teaches economics at Cornell, says there's nothing stopping companies from doing those things now.
The interest rates are very low. Firms are sitting on a lot of cash. If they have a profitable investment opportunity, they can undertake it right now, immediately, without any tax cut.
Frank says corporations are more likely to use potential tax savings for a different purpose, shareholder payouts. That's what happened last time companies got a big tax break in 2004. And since then, shareholders have been pressuring companies for higher dividends. Eric Irvin heads the ETF issuer Reality Shares.
The shareholders have really demanded this, where they say, as earnings are growing for this business, we want those earnings to be paid back to us in the form of dividends.
If companies use their tax savings to pay higher dividends to shareholders, that could, in its own way, drive economic growth. Kent Smetters teaches economics at the Wharton School.
Some of that money is going to be invested in other companies. Some of it's going to be consumed today. So all that is stimulating for the economy.
But Professor Frank at Cornell offers a caveat about shareholders. They tend to be people at the top of the income ladder.
The propensity to spend out of extra income on the part of the rich is very low compared to everyone else.
So putting more money in shareholders' pockets will only help the economy if they spend it. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
According to the good people at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, childcare workers in this country get some of the lowest salary and benefit packages, not just in the education field, but of any profession in the country. That's just one of the reasons turnover in early education is so high and qualified teachers are in such short supply. In California, school districts have started offering more pre-kindergarten programs, which has kind of shaken up the education economy quite a bit. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Priska Neely has the story.
Are we playing the hot potato game?
Yeah. A beanbag flies through the air as beaming 3- and 4-year-olds hastily pass it along, trying not to get stuck with the hot potato.
Uh-oh, how many of you guys got burned?
10 times.
10 times?
Selma Sanchez is out with the kids today. She's actually the program director of the Child Development Consortium Los Angeles and oversees 10 preschool sites. But lately, she's been filling in as a teacher. At this center, 90% of the staff left for other jobs in recent months.
I've been interviewing like crazy.
Most of the staff went to work at a Head Start center that opened nearby. That federally funded preschool program pays slightly better than the $20 an hour she can offer. She can't find candidates with bachelor's and master's degrees who will settle for that rate. One person who was willing to take the pay had never taken a child development course.
She had like over 5 years of experience, but no education. And that's who we hired.
Because that's what you can get.
That's all I could get.
Finding qualified teachers is often a challenge, but Sanchez says a recent change to the state's education system has exacerbated hiring issues. It's called TK, Transitional Kindergarten.
TK has been affecting us since they started.
California's pre-kindergarten program for 4-year-olds has been around since 2012. Unlike grade school teachers, the people who care for and educate little kids make vastly different amounts of money depending on the funding stream of the program and the age of the children. So if early childhood education is a food chain, transitional kindergarten is the new big fish, and it's gobbling up a lot of the resources, including qualified teachers.
I could teach TK and probably make like double what I'm making now.
That's Stephanie Guerrero, a site supervisor at a preschool in Glendale, California. She loves her job, but has trouble paying all of her bills. She makes about $38,000 a year.
Like, you don't get paid enough. You start to feel like, what am I doing here?
She already has her bachelor's and is getting her teaching credential and hopes to start teaching TK next year. Nationwide, as more school districts step in to provide education for kids under 5, more teachers are making this leap. So the early child care providers that pay less are scrambling.
You could say this was an unintended consequence, but it was actually quite a predictable consequence.
Marcy Whitebook runs the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment at the University of California, Berkeley.
When people with the same qualifications are being paid dramatically different salaries, then of course you're going to see this movement.
Whitebook's analysis found that about a third of pre-K and kindergarten teachers nationwide use some form of federal income support, like food stamps. More and more states are investing in early childhood programs. A growing body of research on early brain development shows these programs help children succeed later in life. That, in turn, has increased the demand for qualified teachers. But for now, getting a bachelor's degree in early childhood education has the lowest projected earnings for any college major. Several cities and states are working toward evening out salary differences among all kinds of teachers. But in California, the gap persists. And without change, providers say the shortage of preschool educators will only get worse. In Los Angeles, I'm Priska Neely for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Warren Buffett takes the subscription clothing model one step too far. Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns Fruit of the Loom, as you may know. That company has decided to offer a new service, subscription underwear, a six-pack of boxers or whatever your preference, auto-reordered every 6 months at a 30% discount. It's called Fruit to Your Door. Said a company spokesman, quote, "You might see a lot of moms doing this for their kids in college," end of quote. To which I say, quote, "To all moms of college kids everywhere, just don't do that. Don't." All right, we are out of here. The Dow up 1.3% today, 331 points. NASDAQ up 0.7%, about 49 points. S&P 500 gained 0.8%, 21 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.